Carl Valley is CEO of Spikes Only and a real expert in the world of track and field, speed, and sports technology. In this exciting interview, we discuss what Olympians really need to do for peak performance and where sports tech is headed. Thanks for listening.
Back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Today we're calling across to my hometown with Carl Valley in Boston, Massachusetts. Carl is a sports technologist from Spikes Only. He works with a bunch of different sports and has a pretty varied background. He's a real expert in the areas of sports technology especially. So I'm pretty excited to talk to him today. Welcome on the show, Carl.
Thanks for having me. It's great to have another Boston guy.
So around the world right now, including right here, we've got athletes finishing up 4 years of training their butts off. They've now been named in squads or completed trials and qualified. They're, gearing up hotel, bookings for their families and everything. And they might be doing what someone called taper, which I roll my eyes at. They might be, doing all sorts of different super compensation strategies. What, in your eyes, do people do wrong in terms of preparing to peak at a tournament, at a pinnacle event? And what, in your mind, are the best methods to manage load and manage long training periods to peak?
Well, that's obviously you're talking about the holy grail of Olympic sport and sometimes team sport is managing load in order to peak when it counts. And it's tough because you have two trains of thought and you also have two major pipelines. You have the Olympic sport where everything is kind of dictated by the calendar of choice. Track and field and swimming, there's a lot of options to where you want to compete. You can choose to pick your battles. So it's what the coach and athletes are doing is trying to find a way. Yeah, you want to peak for the Olympics. Maybe you have a trials if you're, North Americans and some other athletes and other sports. Swimming, for example, you have track and field and swimming trials, and you have to do that in order to make it to the Olympics. You can't just decide to show up. Like other countries don't have that quote luxury of trials because they just don't have people to qualify. So Olympic sport is obviously going to be different than, a team battling to make the playoffs and then week to week to keep going. So you saw that with, an example would be, you can think that you're Golden State and all you have to do is, rest and peak guys for the end. But most teams don't have the luxury of being of that caliber. You're worried about just getting there. Another example is the San Antonio Spurs is what happened when people rested a few years ago. That created a problem. So just getting there on the starting line is sort of like, that's the first step is to remember that you got to get there to have a chance. And everyone talks about working backwards. If you go to any training theory conference, the best coaches will always share how they schedule and prepare, and they always work backwards. And that makes sense. The calendar, when you look at periodization, just a fancy word for planning. And when you look at planning, the easy proxy to planning is usually the calendar. So when I was at a clinic and with coaching, a friend of mine, Randy Gillen, who's now at Illinois, he asked about microcycles to one of the most prestigious coaches in sprint history. And, he threw his hands up in the air and said, "Hey, microcycles, I'm just talking about weeks." He was trying to play coy with this whole process. And the reason I bring that up is that I think people need to start with not only the season that they're looking at, but the previous seasons. And with coaching changes, you see this, I'm reading this right now, that so many athletes, and even what was really interesting is just recently you had an athlete in gymnastics, Gabby. She changed her coach during the last competition. And these are the things that occur that are realistic. So coaching changes, deciding to relocate and, you know, make all these changes. I think the easiest thing to do when you're deciding to manage load is to model. And I got into a little bit of a nasty discussion recently. I'm at fault for it because everyone says monitoring. I said, well, you kind of monitor the plan to make sure that your model is working. So if anyone from this podcast, they taped and video recorded my presentation at the NHL strength and conditioning little seminar. And I brought up the whole point of modeling so that right now, the biggest mistake that people are doing, they're so obsessed with the access of technology that they're monitoring fatigue, which is when you talk about ghosts, you're going to start seeing ghosts when you tell ghost stories. So everyone's scared of getting tired. Like it's like, you know, it's some sort of like zombie virus. Oh my God, let's say a prayer. He's breathing heavy. So I think what we need to do is look at what a model is, and people have to not just plan training. You know, it's easy to write workouts. I mean, I've done that and made some terrible mistakes. But if people have a model, they can say what things, either key performance indicators, the great coach Path, you know, he uses KPIs. You got to have a model to say, when I do these things, these type of things happen, versus if I have these special workouts, it's going to mean something. So instead of looking at workouts, think about adaptations. And instead of just planning, which is, you should be planning. Why are you getting all excited about it? Create a model and say, hey, if I tweak these things, we can get faster, or we can be more explosive, or endurance is optimized. So I think that's one of the things with the load. I mean, such an easy word to throw around there. And what drives me nuts is these charts with these line plots and bar charts to represent a very complex process of the human biology.
And how tall are the error bars in all of those that you see?
Yeah, so it's like someone goes, here's your load. And it's like, and it's always arbitrary units or something that is completely, you know, vague. And you can only do so much. I understand that RPE and, you know, maybe some minutes. Hey, it's a good working number because those are significant inputs. But the inputs need to move away from, you know, something as, you know, mileage and stuff like that. There's so much more that's going on. Because if all that stuff was great, then, you know, where's all these bulletproof athletes? We still see injuries increasing. You know, everyone's looking to see that, you know, other countries outside the U.S. are going to save us from, you know, the problems. And I said this recently with the team.
People should keep hiring people working outside the U.S., Carl. These are not the droids you're looking for. These are not the droids you're looking for.
No, I actually in favor of just getting whoever is necessary on the sports science. I think there's been a backlash with the Americans, and there should be, because the U.S. is very exercise science driven. So I like the fact that there's people from the U.K., New Zealand, and Australia, because you prevent the inbreeding that occurs when you only hire within. On the other hand, the outside the box people, sometimes they miss. It's okay to be creative, but once you start to get so esoteric, you lose the reality. For example, NBA, you might play 3 or 4 games in a week. Well, you see all these models that are in rugby and soccer. It's like Monday through Friday is all these intricate periodization schemes. And then you have a game, then you have a rest day or something similar. NFL, Sunday's usually the game, maybe Monday or, you know, a rare occasion Thursday. But that's kind of clear, not to say it's easy, but what are you going to do with the NHL and the NBA when they're playing multiple games? Where's the, you know, the chronic and acute loading, you know, matrix or algorithm that people have? So I think what we need to do is look at constraints. Ladan Jovanovic has always said this. If you go and Google the term, he and I are very constraint driven. Listen, we only have 24 hours in the day. Most people want to sleep 8 hours. You maybe have 2 to 5 hours of access to the athlete every few days. You're not going to lift every day. So looking at team sport, I think that's where people start to have the biggest problems, because you get more chaos involved. Obviously, you have collisions in American football. How do you deal with that? It is a contact injury. So there's a lot of things that we have to equate. And I think that, you know, besides modeling, I think we have to look at constraints. What are the limiting variables that we can modify? And then what stuff we just got to leave alone and just accept that, hey, and for example, professional baseball, you know, there's a pitching rotation and there's things that you can do. Where's the periodization of the relief pitcher? You know, so it's like, you don't know if you're on or off. So I don't know. I mean, those are some things. I mean, these are just ideas off the top of the head, but no one talks about them. Everyone's on social media, rah, rah, rah. And they're like, it's always like these, of course, it's 140 characters. And I'm guilty of it more than anyone, that you're trying to throw in a statement and it sounds good. It's a power quote. But then you go back to your laptop to write workouts. And it's like, well, this is not as convenient as what everyone was saying. Because there's things that no one wants to talk about.
Also, it's so popular to quote that, you know, the most dangerous thing to say is we've always done it this way. But that notion rules so much of our everything. It rules so many of our actions and so many of our systems that we exist in every day. So it's not so simple, you know.
Well, like I said earlier, being creative to a point. I mean, I've been told I was unconventional, which might be either a negative word or a compliment. But I've always felt like, hey, I have eyes too. And I also have, you know, when I was coaching swimming, you know, and you always have to ask yourself is, you know, what can we do better? And what stuff we just need to leave alone? Because probably some smarter people thought about it 20 years ago. I mean, not much has changed in sport. You know, no one's going to start making some radical changes in basketball, and you're not going to see like diaper shots again, because we've seen the evolution. Even if it was going like Rick Barry style, just the society right now, no guy wants to do an underhand throw if they're shooting 60% at the line. So there's a lot of things that are a little bit more complicated than that. But if I can get one thing that is going to be drilled down to people, it's that modeling isn't just for the, you know, for sky cycling or whatever. Modeling is something that has been around for decades. I think we just need to embrace it. And I haven't been a proponent of it that much, because I always felt it should be natural. But with all the bastardization we've seen with periodization, where you know, you see a 6-week off season and then people are talking about blocks, you know, and it's like 4-day blocks. And it's like, this is when it became, you know, like the scheduling of pro sport is entertainment and calendar driven. So it's not really designed for, you know, utopian performances. It's designed to make sure that the fans get to see the product. So I think it's not going to change. I mean, when I really see these NBA articles on ESPN or Sports Illustrated, I say, well, how did these guys able to do all of this stuff in the 80s and 90s? You know, how did Jordan? I mean, he had a foot injury, and then when he came back, he had that knee issue with the Wizards. But he was a guy that played the same amount of games as everyone else. He didn't have access to all of this, you know, laser regeneration and stem cells and all the stuff that people are overhyping. You know, it just came from natural work. So that's what is concerning me, is that, you know, everyone's talking about sleep, and there is a problem, because I think there's a lot of things going on just with the travel schedules. But what about the, you know, professional baseball when they were using trains? It's like, you know, it's just like we forget how pampered these guys are. So it's a lot of it psychological. It's like, oh my God, you're going to go from Boston to Chicago and there's going to be a time zone change. Do we really need to be freaked out about that? So enough ranting. I think it's probably good to switch a topic before people get, annoyed.
Cool. Okay. Let's get into some tech, Carl. I think
those of us in the field who spend much time on social media or going to conferences definitely consider you to be one of the leading minds out there in terms of both judging tech and, you know, what's useful and what's not, and also knowing how to use it. I think most of us would agree that GPS has kind of come full circle in the last 5 years or so. Let's start there and talk about, where's GPS at? Where is it headed? Will we even be using GPS anymore, you know, 5 years from now, or will it just be accelerometers? And how can teams actually use it sensibly?
All right. So I want to make sure it's known that I'm in favor of simple GPS technology. So there's been some misinterpretation that I hate GPS. And it's far from, you know, the truth, because I believe that GPS is part of that pie. The question is, what percentage? So when you look at sports, let's say you take European soccer, where do you think practices and GPS data lie in? Probably a big slice of the pie, right? So as training decreases, what do people tend to do? More monitoring, right? You got to look busy, right? If you can't change a variable, you monitor what they're actually doing, because you're not getting, you know, like, you're not seeing like an English Premier League club and talking about, you know, bar speed on Olympic lifts, right? You're not going to see, right? So you just want to get guys to lift, period, you know? So monitoring and GPS are seen as, you know, or sometimes they use the word player tracking. So let's get to the details and create a definition that is accurate. When you look at a product or a tool or an instrument, that's probably a better term, because people look at some of this, the hardware, and they think toys. But GPS is a tool, it's an instrument, and the purpose of it is to get displacement, right? A rough estimate of how far you've traveled. Now, if you're looking at soccer, for example, a very open sport outdoors, it makes sense, right? In a game, someone's going to go over 10 kilometers. So that's a simple and easy way to say how much work they're doing. You're trying to estimate load. My biggest problem with GPS is that the data, in terms of the precision, isn't going to be used to time people at the Rio Olympics. So no one appreciates a hundredth or maybe a couple hundredths more than myself. So it's just easy to say, well, they're going these velocities. So usually what happens is, when you look at the reporting, now there's companies like Catapult, there's GPS Sports, there's, you know, Stat Sports.
Yeah, we use VX and we use VX Sport, and we're pretty happy with them. Jamie Tout, their owner, is outstanding.
Yeah.
Because he's a practitioner himself.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, so what we look for that is to say, okay, what work are you doing? Now, does it make sense for an offensive lineman to have a GPS unit on? Teams in baseball are looking at GPS. And I said, okay, when you say GPS, it's different than maybe they say, okay, we're using Catapult system, which has other sensors in there. So what people need to know is, if you're looking at purely GPS, it might be appropriate for a 5K runner or a marathoner just trying to get simple mileage, which is fine. I mean, that's great. But when you're looking at the big picture, because of the technology, you have to look at something a little bit more complicated. Because when you see the injury lists on the NFL, you never see, you know, poor HRV, bad load metric. You see something, usually a joint or muscle. You know, what's limiting someone? It's usually they pulled something, they had a concussion, or like they have some sort of joint issue. So I think with GPS, I think come full circle, I've attacked them and saying, you know, if you're only looking at that, what's your job? And I can understand if you're a team coach and you're trying to modulate the week, especially in the sports that are weekly in terms of competition. But what do you do if you're in ice hockey, right? You know, it's such a small rink, you know, you're not really, you know, it doesn't really make sense. Then you got American football, which is the most insane thing ever. You have these coaches who are thinking that GPS is going to solve all their problems. And I said, all right, an American football field is a green ruler that's oversized. It's already measured, right? A lot of the plays are choreographed, right? So you'll have certain plays in practice. How could you not understand what you did? How many snaps you have? So it's okay if you're trying to figure out what's going on with a sport such as rugby and you're trying to get work rates. They're doing a great job down there. But when they try to translate it to the NFL, that's when I start wondering, like, okay, what are you trying to do? So I think that GPS has come full circle because people are starting to realize that it's not GPS. There's accelerometers. There's a gyro, so you can get orientation. You can get directional information from a good IMU board. So, yeah, that tracking is helping. But I've said earlier on an earlier podcast is that the human body is not a round orb on a screen. We're not a chess piece. So when you see all these graphic visualizations, you get someone's velocities, but you don't see how they ran, right? And you've seen this when you have some guy running and you're wincing because he has extremely high heel recovery. He's almost kicking his own butt, right? And it's very sloppy technique. And, you know, he's not prepared in the weight room. So there's so many variables that you have to see what's causing the injury. So that's why I'm very hesitant to say, okay, if you get GPS and it's dirt cheap, it's going to solve your problems. What is it worth? 5% of the solution? I don't have an answer. But I think people have to calm down and start looking at GPS as a very thin slice of the pie, still valuable. But if teams are looking for that to say, we're going to reduce injuries, well, are you talking to your head coach? There's one NFL coach, an assistant, and he said this. I won't mention his name because he won't get me tickets. He says, just get off the field. We have a problem. We're doing too much. And if you have a core volume issue and it's still manifesting with the whatever data visualizations you're seeing, you're just having the head coach and the assistant coach not on the same page. So far, until I see a YouTube video of an NFL or NCAA top program of a head coach explaining his weekly microcycle and saying, well, this is how we're manipulating the variables to keep the guys fresh, but still rehearse the tactical and technical things, then I'm going to be a believer. But what really is, and no one wants to say, is like, we just need to do less. And how can we come up with a way to beg and plead with some sort of objective information just to tone it down a notch, right? And you being a Boston guy, could you imagine Tom Brady doing a 3/4 day? You know, there's no arena football, small-sided games approaches where guys are just throwing 3/4 speed because timing routes have to be at full speed. Right, you're not gonna. It's really difficult to rehearse a moderate day in an NFL. It's usually full speed ahead, and then you may manipulate the volumes or giving a day rest or a walkthrough. But it's how do you manipulate that? You know, so I think that's where things are going to change. Is where, you know, we're going to move away from just GPS.
Yeah, I think you're right. That actually transitions really nicely into something we've gone at on Twitter a little bit and talked about kind of before we went live, Carl, is I think we have also come full circle on the marginal gains nonsense, and I will call it that. Congratulations to Team Sky for convincing the world that their success is due to bringing their own pillows on airplanes. But I think most people in the field would agree that there are some big rocks which are rarely, rarely taken care of by most setups. What, in your mind, are the biggest rocks and how can they be looked after?
Yeah, I think that, and then let's just talk about big rocks, okay? We've all read that passage with the professor that, you know, has big rocks, then smaller rocks, then sand, and he pours the beer at the end. That's a great story. How is that really helping anyone? You know, now if that was Dr. Nick from the All Blacks and he told that story and he explained that the big rocks were like squad. So, you know, you're blessed with a guy that's, down in New Zealand that's doing both research and seeing with his eyes the essentials. Now, you can argue that he's talking about maximizing the fundamentals, right? And polishing the essentials. So you could say, yeah, he's taking big rocks and he's just trying to make sure those big rocks are better. I like that. It sounds sort of like anti-marginal gains. You know, if you look at it, I like that. It's, you finally have maximal gains. So I like maximal gains, not marginal gains. You know, if you ever bought a car, what type of shape is it? Oh, it's marginal shape. No, I don't like that. I want maximal. So being an aggressive guy, I think it makes sense to say, let's go pursue things that are more impactful. And it's usually the stuff that is more of a human issue. For example, in the NBA, there are a lot of people on social media talking about strength training. But every time I see Instagram videos, it's either foam rolling, it's a TRX exercise that's body weight for, quote, movement quality. It's a non-exercise. It's a non-lift or strength training. So Mike Nelson did a presentation in Austin, Texas in February, and he says you probably need to do the opposite of what you're doing if you have a problem, because what you're doing that's creating the problem isn't working. So I know that he said a lot more in that presentation than that, but that to me makes me realize that if you have issues that are limiting your quote model, those are usually the human error and the human element things. So like, for example, you know, like bringing your pillows to the tour, the question is, what's that worth? Are they claiming that, you know, some pillows are going to get you a lot more wattage on the bike? Yeah, I believe in good sleep. In fact, there's a guy that does consulting and he's from the UK and he's actually providing those things. But at this point of time, everyone has that now. So the marginal gains, how many years are you going to use the pillow technique? So I'm just anti-marginal gains. I think it's just doing the stuff that we all know we need to do, but it's usually convincing athletes to do it. And it's usually sacrifice, not getting people to train hard. A lot of guys train hard, but they also don't recover because they're not willing to sacrifice. So I think the big rocks, if because people are fluent with that analogy, we should start thinking about being honest and saying, are you willing to sacrifice things to get better? Are you willing to remove the distractions? So I think we should start looking at not necessarily the training, more on the recovery side, and start focusing on, you know, the sacrifices. Everyone's willing to do something. How many people are willing to give up something? So that's where I navigate my energies to, is convincing people that, hey, it will be worth it, but you're just going to have to give up or change something. And that's a sacrifice. So that's what my quote, big rocks are.
That is a pretty good answer, Carl. I think the other main thing that I wanted to ask you about today, because it relates so specifically to something I'm doing, is interpretation of research for programming in elite sport. Now, Carl, my PhD is in a single subject design with an applied team during an Olympic year. It's very much an A-B intervention design. It's about as niggly as you can get with a research design. So I've had to jump through so many hoops just to get it approved. And to get it published will be a whole other bag. But I'm interested to hear your take, kind of from the coaching side, but someone who's also very involved and excited by research. How can practitioners who are trying to do a good job at their job by staying on top of the literature interpret what they read with intelligence and apply it tactfully?
That's a good question. And I said this earlier on another podcast, but this is a perfect opportunity to expand upon this, because it was just like 5 or 6 seconds. It was just a kind of an errant comment. And I was talking about resistance sprinting and sleds and all these details. And what happens is, and I'm guilty of this, I'll tweet something on social media sharing like a good research study, and you'll get a lot of mixed reviews. You'll get someone that thinks that this is uncovering the, you know, the the lost secrets of the Aztecs or whatever. And then other people will say, hey, it was only with female subjects. I work with males. So taking research, there's a limitation to it. You know, there's no 4-year study. Actually, there was. There's the guy from the Spurs, Dr. Schelling, had a follow-up study over multiple years. So I'm wrong giving that example. But most of the research, as you know, is going to be short-term, and it's going to isolate a variable to see how they can tease out information. And, you know, and this is the best example that I have in this is resisted sprinting. So you'll see a study that says, okay, this load gets better results than a lighter load. And you look at the setup and the design, it's very obvious. They did a certain amount of sprinting at a certain amount of times a week with a specific load, one being heavier than the other. My response to that is that who trains like that? I don't only do one thing. Usually, like yourself, you're adding a lifting program. Maybe there's some conditioning. There's some other things that you put into the recipe. So, of course, anyone that sees that, that says, okay, heavier load, better results. Well, then there's look at the subjects. If they're adolescents, any of those athletes will probably get better because they have an absence of a traditional or conventional lifting program. So if they're not getting any type of resistance training and you throw in a load, of course they're going to respond better because that's probably the hidden factor. So when we're looking at research, you got to ask yourself, what's the mechanism or the cellular adaptation that you're trying to impose? Is there any variables within the variables that are causing these changes? So instead of looking at correlation, we need to obviously look at causation. So when you look at research, look at the broad spectrum of it and then test it yourself. I hate when people don't look at their own data and saying, hey, did my own program work? That's the ultimate research, because the athletes that's there is depending on you, not the research studies that are being thrown out there on PubMed. So I made the mistake countless year after year of just saying, okay, here's the summary. No, I'll read the full study and then look at the interpretation of the researcher who might not be very fluent in understanding training theory. So I think that the best thing to do for people is to read the research in entirety. Don't skim it. Don't skip to the end and saying, okay, I should do this, because usually those type of approaches, they lead you to chase your own tail for years. What I like to do is to say, hey, is this a possible variable to manipulate? And then my favorite one-liner from Richard Tolman is, what's it worth? Right? And I said this about electrical muscle stimulation. Is it worth a tenth? Is a vibration platform worth 3/10? Is it worth 1/100? When all the variables wash out of a comprehensive holistic program, you're always going to have to ask, what is this decision worth? An example, and I know you've probably heard about this, is the term French contrast training. All right, so now my Christmas card list has shrunk after saying that. Now, you can argue that, well, Carl, you're the one that posted Werner Gunther's stuff. Of course I did. Well, that's a world-class specimen, freak of nature. I love French contrast, but how many people really have the preparation in our Olympic sports? Then we fast forward to some YouTube channel, always with the latest hip-hop music, showing some 15-year-old female basketball athlete who's never lifted before doing 6-foot depth jumps in this grotesque circuit-style formation with people screaming in the background for no reason. So I think it comes down to all of this stuff is about what's it worth. And the big rocks, like you said, you start off with the binary question, attendance. Are you there training? And that's why I've explained to a lot of people that my programs, because of guys like Hank Krezhanoff, it's getting to the starting line. And the people that are trying to get marginal gains by doing super heavy training, I'm like, it just doesn't make any sense what people are doing. what's it worth? If you're doing a 40-yard dash, you know, what is this huge mammoth plyometric routine going to equate to? You know, if you're sprinting, lifting, and doing a basic jump routine, maybe some medicine ball throws, you're covering the bases. But usually everyone has a fetish. So if you look at any the information out there, always be very careful. Anyone that has a specific enjoyment of a very narrow subject matter, because of course they're going to promote that one exercise or that one movement pattern or one piece of equipment. You want to have a continuum of solutions. And that's what happens with trends. So what happened recently? Everyone's doing French contrast methods. But what about the people that didn't do any type of plyometrics running extremely fast? And that's why I think the Usain Bolt, you know, training gets people angry, because they say, well, he's got great genetics. True. And I always say this to the other people that don't have good genetics. Well, if you're doing something beyond what the elite people are doing and they're not doing it, chances are that just because you're doing more or doing more intense doesn't mean that it's going to work better. So I think that's the problem with interpretation, is to say, hey, is this as potent as the research study says? And do your homework. A lot of coaches will say, wow, this really improved this person's speed. And you see this research study, and I'm like looking at the timing gate splits, and these guys would be destroying the entire country of Jamaica. This is an adolescent, like, soccer academy in some random country. And it's clear that they didn't do the setup properly, or they didn't measure things out.
Yeah, they just forget to mention that it was rolling starts.
Okay, let's say it is a rolling start. Okay, what's that rolling start worth? It's not worth you destroying Asafa Powell in for 30 meters when you're 13. So yeah, maybe it's a one step fly-in, and they put the timing gates a meter out. That's why you should always do your own measurements of your own system, and not try to mix and match so much. So I'll just cut it off there before the rant becomes monotonous, and just move to the next question.
It's all good, man. It's all good. It's good stuff. And like, I think it really resonates. The French contrast training is a great one. And, I'm loath to say this, but so I'm a contractor for another national sporting organization besides New Zealand Rugby here. And one of the regional coaches who does programming that I deliver recently wanted to put in some French contrast training. And he's a brilliantly lovely bloke and he's a darn good coach. And I gave it 2 weeks of trying it out. And then I said, man, this isn't for this group. You know, this isn't for this group. And also, more than anything, when you're saying that stuff, I think you give good examples of how people bastardize it. I just giggle when stuff is given really cool names. I'm like, French contrast training, does that mean we have to eat a baguette while training, or, you know, be doing a wine critique while training? I don't understand why.
Yeah, there should be some sort of like downloadable app that you can choose a country, choose either a barbell or a jumping activity, and then, you know, throw in a neuromuscular adaptation. Because it's always by three things. You need the Trinity. So yeah, I'm sure. And the reason that they said French, and the guy that won the world championship a few times in the shot put is a Switzerland guy. He's Swiss. So it's like, why not give, you know? Because why aren't there like 10 Werner Gunthers, you know? And I know Valerie is doing some stuff, but you know, she's pretty talented and she's kind of already a gold medalist. So it's like, people are going to go, whatever she does, I'm going to be horrified, because we're going to start seeing it in youth soccer. And, you know, they're going to say, hey, if it's good enough for her, you know, we're going to somehow bastardize it. And this is a mature thing. I mean, we're adults. It's not like kids are getting this stuff from, you know, Instagram video and doing it themselves. We're getting people that are in their mid-40s saying, you know what? My kids don't know how to do plyometrics effectively and safely. And week two, let's do French contrast. And it's like, that's the issue, is the extremism. So, you know, don't fall in love. Dr. Fleck said this, you know, 15, 20 years ago, says don't fall in love with an exercise, and don't adopt anything quickly until you really, you know, really know what to do with it and slowly blend it in. So enough negativity. Let's maybe we can learn about recovery with the pool workouts.
Okay, let's hit that quickly, and then I've got my final three hits for you.
Okay.
Give us in about 2 minutes. What's some accessory work that people should be doing that they're not? So pool workouts is definitely one. I really like gymnastics. Talk about those and some others for us.
Yeah, so I'll go into, my core program was ripped off from diving. So, I'm not having people go off high boards and, like a 3 meter board and, do a somersaults into the into the water. I just think that you can learn a lot from a very ballistic sport. And the question is, does it transfer? Is it safe? Do you need to be doing like insane, circus acts on the core? I just believe that, Olympic sports like that, when the rubber hits the road or when the person hits the pool, they're going to look at really constructive ways to prepare, your core. So I think core training, yes, you can't make it overzealous, but I think that people should be looking into gymnastics and diving specifically, because I find their routines are sensible. I mean, they care about injuries too, so they're not doing anything foolish. It's not like, it's going to cause, lumbar spines to explode. There's a lot of things that they found out that can help. Now, I'm also a pool workout guy. I think that we're not seeing enough of low impact conditioning. And I think people are lazy, that they don't want to find a pool. They don't want to schedule. They don't want to get wet. And, the administrative burdens of knowing who can swim and who's a great swimmer, who can't swim at all. I think swimming's a really, not swimming per se is doing laps, but the aquatic recovery, it means something. So I think that any type of field sport should do it once a week. 40 minutes, 20 minute workout, 10 minute warm up, and then 10 minute stretch. If you do that, I guarantee that it's going to show up either in the blood chemistry, your autonomic nervous system readings, or whatever proxy way that you're looking at it.
Fair enough. I'm a pretty big fan of any kind of off feet conditioning, so I definitely like that one. Yeah, my colleague here, Pierre Gibbs, our regional strength and conditioner, keep trying to talk him into doing a research master's on that, because we both love programming it. So if a practitioner, let's say mid, realistically late 20s, Carl, just landed his first legit job in the field and wants to, continue stepping his game up and keep getting better all the time, what are three resources that you look up to or rely on or believe in? So three practitioners or researchers or three ideologies.
It's hard. I mentioned his name, Hank Krajnov. He is speaking at the Central Virginia seminar. And to me, he's extremely holistic. So that's a great starting point. His mind is just a beautiful gift. So I think starting off with him would be a smart way, because he sees the big picture of the big picture. And he has, he's just so pioneering. All this stuff with velocity-based training, and I'm probably part of the people that kind of created a little bit of the, the hype, because everyone, I'm trying to feed the interest of what people, because there's so much technology. He was doing all this stuff with Muscle Lab in the early 90s, like 1991, 92. So I think Hank is a great starting point. Obviously, I'm influenced on the track and swimming side. So I think there's a guy that I'm kind of following now is Keenan Robinson. And everyone's going to say, well, he has it easy. He has Michael Phelps. I think anytime you have someone of that caliber, there's a learning process that is that the amount of pressure that is on that team, not just Michael. I just love the guy. I think that he's just so open. I think he's a guy that has seen the top of the mountain, and he's just always learning. So I think from another person, I think those two gentlemen are just worth learning from. And then I will throw a little bit of a curveball. We have the medical strength conditioning. We have someone that has a rich background in track and field. A guy that I've been following for 20 years is my own soft tissue therapist, Travis Skaggs, and he's in St. Petersburg. So when you go down to Florida, you can go and visit if you can go and have the drive time. There's something to be said for a manual therapist that has spent decades working with numerous Olympic athletes. And I cringe every time I see his website because it looked like it was made in Netscape Navigator in 97. But I mean, the guy, he books up. And when I go down to Florida, it's because usually someone got hurt and they got re-injured. And then they're smart enough to realize that maybe there's another idea. And so I usually get a call saying, hey, this guy needs to get rehabbed. And it's usually the hamstring or groin. What's the next steps? And the next steps I always say is get a flight down to Tampa Bay and, you know, book up an Airbnb for a few weeks and I'll be down there in in 2 or 3 days, like kind of like Pulp Fiction when the wolf came. And I admit that my support is more of an emotional, sport psychology of getting people to be confident enough to sprint. I'm not changing, a 34-year-old, receiver in the NFL, his running technique. I'm just there to make sure that he knows that, whatever he's learned in the past is the past. So I think the sports psychology of rehab is just, he's positive, he gets results, and I just see those three people on the top of my head. There are so many other people I haven't mentioned. One of my mentors is Håkan Andersson, who's a Swedish sprint national coach. There's so many great people that, for me, just to narrow it down, Landon Evans, probably call him. He's a lot brighter and more successful than me on the strength conditioning side. I think he's an amazing resource. He's my free therapist when people start tweeting low carbs to increase mitochondrial biogenesis with soccer players. So guys like him are wonderful. So I think, you said three, I gave five, so there's no, there shouldn't be any resentment.
Oh, extra value. All right, last question. What are, what's at least one and up to three non-training books that have impacted your life that you would recommend people read? And don't say Anti-Fragile.
All right, so, and this is, you can see that I'm pausing because I don't have a balance. I've bought tons of non-training books and they would give me paper cuts because I haven't opened them up. I always say this is going to be summer reading at the beach, and a guy like myself just can't just lie down and just get a tan. So I think, and I'll just give you my philosophy on books that are not, non-specialty or non-professional books. I think they can be anything. They don't have to teach you anything. I think there's something to be said for reading a good yarn. So there's a lot of stuff that's, I say, loosely related. Mind of the Raven is a great book. And that guy's from Vermont. He's also a distance runner. So he wrote another book called Why We Run, but the Mind of the Raven is a great read because it just doesn't have like a purpose. The leadership books drive me nuts because you'll see this. Everyone's talking about leadership and it's like, are you that bad of a personality that you need to spend, $800 on leadership books? Is that really holding you back? So the leadership books, I'm not a big fan of. If you need that, you should have a better mentor. I've been blessed with amazing coaches when I was in high school. So I'm lucky, but I'm not a big leadership book guy because it's great for that person. Another book I think that is a good challenge is Goodell Escher Bach. My friend, my own guru, Brendan Wright, gave that to me to make me feel stupid. So that's an excellent book to get people to really push their outside their comfort zone. And then the third book, I like Hackers and Painters by Paul Graham. The reason I like that is because it talks about design. And so I think a similar synonym to modeling is designing. I think we need to understand design better. And that means not going to the Apple store and saying, okay, I really like what, Johnny Ives is doing. I mean, he's amazing. I'm not going to deny that. I mean, I probably get more excited to see him at an expo than, a couple of the pro athletes I look up to. But I think that type of approach to, hackers and painters, I think that whole concept is just ingenious. So those are the big three, non-sports training books. And as you can see, I don't have a lot of them because I think I'm inside the box, because inside the box works pretty well.
Fair enough. Carl Valley, thank you so much for your time today. I think that's some awesome content for the listeners, and I'm really excited to publish this one.
All right. Well, I hope that, at least people are just going to Amazon and getting some good reads. Hopefully they didn't fast forward to the end, but I think in the middle we had some good discussions, and I think it's a mature and honest way to reflect upon what are the true problems that we need to overcome in order to make progress. So Jake, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be on your podcast.
Awesome, Carl. Speak soon.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you leave a review of this podcast on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me, as well as a big high five. Stay tuned for interviews with Dr. Jeremy Shepherd and Steve Ingham. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.